From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Davis Sobel had been waiting a long time to write her book about the women at the Harvard Observatory. The story she first discovered some 20 years ago now was about Henrietta Leavitt, whose exploration into the brightness of stars in the cosmos transformed the way we think of the universe. Sobel learned that Henrietta had been one woman in a room full of women at Harvard. And this was in the 1890s, women scientists making discoveries at a time when there weren't really opportunities for women. So Sobel started digging, and the book she's now finished features the stories of a number of remarkable women scientists. Today in the program, a conversation with Davis Sobel. We'll also talk about a play opening in Salt Lake City this week about Henrietta Leavitt and her passion for stars and light. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's no doubt about it. The science in Davis Sobel's book is intricate and complex, like the period-luminosity relationship for pulsating variable Cepheid stars. But her new book is also about the personal stories of the remarkable women behind some of these pioneering discoveries in the field of astronomy. Sobel's new book is about the women who worked at the Harvard College Observatory in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. These women weren't necessarily thought of as scientists at the time, but they were good at math and particularly adept at cataloging and comparing the stars photographed on thousands of glass plates, or stellar spectra, as it was called. This is work, Sobel says, that demanded both scrupulous attention to detail and a large capacity for tedium. The book is about the women who did this work and changed the way we think about the universe. Recently, we spoke with Davis Sobel. She's a former New York Times science reporter. Her book is called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. We began with a conversation about the story that first caught Sobel's attention, about Henrietta Leavitt.
About 20 years ago, I was interviewing astronomer Wendy Friedman, who was the head of a Hubble Telescope Key Project about the age and expansion rate of the universe. And she mentioned the name Henrietta Swan Leavitt, a woman who had lived a century ago, as having done work that was fundamental to the Hubble Project. So that was interesting. And then when I went to learn more about Miss Leavitt, because I'd never heard of her before, I found she was working in a room full of women at the Harvard Observatory. And that was really interesting because one doesn't think of Harvard as a place that was welcoming to women in the 1890s, which is when she started there.
And what did you think? I guess that was the jumping off point for a larger story. What did you think? At what point did in your mind it become a book or something larger?
As soon as I learned that there were as many as 20 women at a time working there, that was a great idea. And I needed time to do the research, learn what they actually did, and what sort of lasting effect it had. And I didn't get around to that for a few decades. But over the past decade, this has become a burning desire to write this book. And I'm happy to have done it. Yeah. Turns out the work that the women were doing was of crucial importance in several areas of astronomy and is still in use and in effect today.
I wanted to ask you about these glass plates. I was really interested in the way you write about how they would read them, even how they would handle them. The trick was to hold the packets by the side edges and take this paper off like undressing a baby. You mentioned,
right?
Would you talk about the process, because there's hundreds of these images on these plates that you have to
Well, there are hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you have to be very careful not to touch the photographic emulsion, which is on one side of the plate, and always hold it just by the edges and set it into a frame. They had specially designed wooden frames for reading the glass plates, and the frames had rulers on them so that you could describe the exact position of a certain object. And remember, this was before electricity was really common, really easily available. So the light source for examining the plates was the daylight. And this frame that held the plate had a mirror in the bottom. So you'd position yourself in front of a window and let the sunshine come in, hit the mirror, and bounce up through the plate. And then you could see all the stars or the spread out light of the stars, the spectra, and try to read those and analyze them. And some things could be seen with the naked eye, but most often you'd use a magnifying loop, sometimes even a microscope.
Was it tedious work?
Yes. Not everybody could look at patterns that intently, that closely, pay attention, focus. But it was also tremendously exciting. Here were images taken with long exposure photographs. So stars were appearing that had never been seen. Even the most skilled observer looking through the most powerful telescope can see just what's in front of the eye at that moment, whereas the photographic plate will absorb the light over time. And that's how some of these discoveries were made. Very faint stars that had no one knew existed would appear on the plates.
What's the gift in reading them? And maybe that's not exactly the right word, but it seems identifying this different ranges of brightness, different patterns. Seems like there was quite an art to it.
Yes, and at the beginning of this work, very little was known about the stars. People were just beginning to have a sense of what the stars were made of because of the science of spectroscopy. So that really got going around the 1860s. But that was looking through a telescope and a spectroscope. Now in the 1880s, there were actual photographs of these things. So that allowed for long study and review and for photographs to be taken over periods of time and the same object looked at again and again to see if it was changing. And a remarkable number of variable stars were discovered that way. And a star looks to be one brightness in one image, but a few nights later or even a few hours later, it's a different brightness. Mm-hmm. So what is that about? What's going on?
Let's talk about Edward Pickering, one of the directors.
I love Edward Pickering.
I do too, I have to say.
I'm glad,
and,
yeah.
When he arrives at the Harvard Observatory, it wasn't as if there weren't any women there. It's not like it was his idea to hire women. I mean, he certainly hired a lot eventually, but there were women there at the time.
Yes, there were the wives, sisters, daughters of the resident astronomers who had been roped into doing this or that work, most of it computational work, and he could see that they were fully capable of doing that work. And so when he began taking photographs and really looking at the comparative brightness of the stars, he felt confident that women could do that just as well. And then when he had an influx of money, he hired lots more women, which was a great boon to the women, and it was good for him too. He felt that women were fully capable of the work, and he was open to hiring them, to giving them a chance, even though it was unusual at that time, highly unusual. But also, there was an economic advantage for him because women worked for lower pay, right, which, as we know, still goes on today.
Right. He and his successor, Harlow Shapley, they were fairly progressive for
extremely
for
so.
Day.
Yeah, really made these opportunities for women so important and so attractive. And Pickering put the responsibility for classifying the stars, figuring out a classification system for all the stars, just turned that over to his group of women, and they did it. And when Shapley came along, he thought it would be great to have a real higher education program through the observatory so that graduate degrees in astronomy could be offered. And because of the long history of women working there and fellowships specifically for women to come and work at the observatory, the only funding he had for graduate students was money specifically designated for women. So all the early graduate students in astronomy at Harvard were women, and the first Harvard PhD in astronomy was granted to a woman.
Mm. I want to come back to this funding source because it brings us to two really great characters, Catherine Wolfe Bruce and Anna Palmer Draper. But I wanted to ask you something that you write about Edward Pickering for a moment. And you were sort of referring to this earlier, that Pickering had been shifting the observatory's focus away from, I guess, away from old astronomy. He was looking for novel investigations, you say, into the physical nature of stars. Could you describe that?
Yes. The old astronomy had mostly to do with determining the positions of the stars, which you want to know for navigation. And Pickering was a physicist by training, so he was really interested in light and sound and how things worked, and very interested in photography. And he invented instruments to measure the light of the stars so he could really look at their individual brightness and how that brightness changed over time. Then he could introduce ways to do that on photographic plates. First, he was looking at the brightness of stars through the telescope and through these instruments he invented, which were called photometers.
Yeah.
But then, once he had the glass plates, there was a way of judging the brightness from the images and then, again, looking at the images over time, through the night, through the month, the year, the decade. And all of those kinds of investigations were done mostly by his women employees.
Yeah. How did it shape the way we understand the universe, do you think, these insights?
There were several ways the women's work affected our view of the universe. Being able to have a taxonomy of the stars was very important for scientists to understand that there were different types of stars, and then to ask the question, what is that about? What are we looking at? Are we looking at different chemical compositions? Are we looking at different stages in a life cycle? So the categories had to be defined so that people could really address those questions. And then the work of Henrietta Leavitt enabled people to measure distances across space.
Right.
If you look up at the night sky, you can't really tell what's relatively closer than something else. The brightest things might be the closest, or they might be far away and really much brighter than you realize. So how do you figure that out? And the work done at the observatory was crucial for figuring out a means for measuring distances in space.
Leavitt was noticing, you say, this correlation between the brightness and its period. And she figured that if this pattern holds true, there could be a kind of significance here. And so she comes up with this as you said, this distance scale, which I guess is still used. I'm not sure I understand it properly, but give me a sense of this.
See if I can explain it.
Yes.
So she was looking at photographs taken in the Southern Hemisphere, where there are two large, we now know they're satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, but at the time nobody knew what they were. They were two big groups of stars.
Yeah.
And in those images, she discovered a couple of thousand variable stars. And so she started following a few of them over time. And she figured in each of these groups, all of the stars are roughly the same distance away from us. Mm. So anything in the group that looks brighter really is brighter.
Right.
Because they're all at the same distance. And then she noticed that the brightest stars took the longest time to cycle through their different brightnesses, their pattern of variation, or which she called their period. Mm-hmm. So this is significant.
Yeah.
And she reported it. Other people used her observation to put a calibration on it and to compare the stars she was looking at with similar stars close by within the Milky Way. And then, since they could tie a brightness to a length of time, they could look at the stars in her groups and say, okay, that one's taking 2 weeks. That means it's brightness X, and it looks much dimmer than brightness X. So that is an indication of its distance. And they could do a direct comparison. And so the first revelation was the actual distance of that group of stars she was looking at, which was about 30,000 light years away. Before that, the farthest stars that anybody could gauge a distance to were maybe 100 light years. Now we're really out in space.
Yeah.
And her relationship, her period luminosity relation, was what Hubble used to show that the Milky Way was not the only galaxy,
right,
that those spiral shapes that could be seen were actually entire distant galaxies. So again, Miss Leavitt's stars were crucial to that discovery. And then later, Hubble used them again to show that the universe was expanding.
Yeah. So basically, the most important questions about our universe, we can trace them to her.
Some of the most, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the constitution of the stars. So starting in the 1860s, people could see certain elements present in the stars. And they were elements familiar, most of them, on Earth. Helium was discovered because that was something that appeared in the stars that couldn't be seen on Earth for quite a while. It was a mystery. But nobody knew the relative proportions. There was a sense that probably the stars had contained the elements in more or less the same proportions as they were found on Earth.
Mm.
So Cecilia Payne, who came to Harvard from England because she knew she had no future in astronomy as a woman in England, thought she'd have a better chance at Harvard. And she became the first PhD. And during her research for her doctoral dissertation, she was looking at the actual abundance of different materials in the stars. And she kept coming up with this result that seemed like it couldn't possibly be true, but somehow hydrogen was about a million times more abundant than anything else. And she wanted to put that in her dissertation. And her advisors were nervous about it, told her not to make too much of a fuss over it. So she said this was her finding, but that it was probably a spurious result. And within 4 years, just about every astronomer agreed, you know what, it really is mostly hydrogen.
Yeah. Not a bad love story in Cecilia Payne's life either.
A very, very exciting international love story. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll come back to that because I do want to talk about that. She's She became the first full professor at Harvard in 1956, Cecilia.
She was the first promoted to full professor, I think is how they say it. Huh. I think there was a woman hired to teach in the medical school or to teach biology who was brought in at the full professor level. But Cecilia Payne worked her way up from being a graduate student to finally being recognized as a professor long after she was actually doing it. And then given tenure, even made department chair for a while, although that's usually such a headache. Nobody really wants that job. And she got out of it as quickly as she could.
Right. Dava Sobel, her book is called The Glass Universe. We should also point out on Friday, Pygmalion Theater is opening the play Silent Sky, which focuses on the life of Henrietta Swan Leavitt of the Harvard Observatory. We're going to be talking a bit about that play a little bit later on the program. You can get information about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about an extraordinary group of women in the late 19th and early 20th centuries who made discoveries that have helped us understand the cosmos. We're talking with Dava Sobel, former New York Times science reporter, about her book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Let's go back to the plates. I want to talk about Henry Draper, who really develops, I guess, the technique that captures these images on the plates. And he's an interesting story in that he does all of this work. He's developing it. He has this promising future. He was teaching medicine at NYU, and he's going to stop doing that and then take on this role full time. And then he dies unexpectedly, quite young. And it's left to this really extraordinary woman, his wife, Anna Palmer Draper, to really see this work forward. Talk about Anna Palmer Draper.
She was an heiress, and Henry Draper's partner in his work. Yeah. He trained her, and they made observations together throughout their marriage, which lasted about 15 years until his death. And she was so heartbroken at his loss that she swore she would see the work through somehow. And at first she thought she would do it herself, hire an assistant or maybe two assistants, and just keep going. And she couldn't do it. She couldn't find the right people. And throughout this time, she was talking to Edward Pickering because he was a friend of theirs. Mm. Astronomy is a relatively small field even now, and people know one another. So Pickering was very eager to help somehow. And the way they worked it out, she gave him the money, she gave him her personal fortune, and he did the work. And he hired lots more women to look at the photographic plates. And her gift about tripled the operating budget of the observatory. And she kept up that level of generosity for about 30 years. So she had an enormous impact.
Yeah. I love the story you tell. In fact, you open with it, a dinner party at her house, she and her
right.
And this was in the 1880s, and it just sounded like everyone who was anyone related to that to astronomy in those times, they were there. It must have
everybody
been
was at that dinner party, including Thomas Edison. Yeah. It was the National Academy of Sciences was meeting in New York, so all of the principals were already in the city, and then she just had to say, come to dinner.
Yeah.
And everyone did.
Must have been amazing conversations.
Yes.
Catherine Wolfe Bruce, they were neighbors, didn't live far from Anna Draper.
But Miss Bruce was much older and was a recluse. She was ill much of the time. So she didn't have big dinner parties or even go out much. Mrs. Draper visited the observatory regularly. She yeah. got to know the women there. She loved Pickering and his wife. They even vacationed together sometimes. But Miss Bruce was another story. She didn't get interested and active till she was in her 70s. But very generous. And Pickering needed a fancy new telescope for his satellite observatory in the Southern Hemisphere. And she wrote him a check for $50,000.
You know what I loved about Catherine Bruce is that even later in life, and maybe she'd always been this way, she had this deep inquisitive nature, it seemed. The more you say that she read about, you know, the ingredients of stars, the more questions that she had, and that seemed to drive her. And she also had a sense, you say, that she saw these new findings coming. She had a sense that this was an exciting period, I guess, in astronomy.
She had read an article by an astronomer who said that there probably wasn't much left to learn.
Right.
We hear these things in science all the time. You know, it's the end of physics, or that's the death of some other realm, and then turns out there's more to discover. And that was her spirit, that the astronomer who had written that article was mistaken. And the funny thing is, she got to know him, and he changed his mind, and the two of them became quite friendly.
These women were derisively known as the harem, Pickering's harem,
I guess. Well, it isn't clear to me, even after all the research I've done, when that term was applied to them. It was certainly nothing that Pickering ever said, and it may have come up in the 1970s. Looking back on the group, if it was a contemporary term, I don't know who used it, because it isn't recorded anywhere.
Huh. So many in this group, the extraordinary, and the age range was really remarkable too.
And the longevity. Some of the people stayed there for 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me tease out a few. Wilhelmina Fleming, I loved. She has this predicament that she's in. She's in a delicate condition.
Yes.
Edward Pickering supports her, though. She gets pregnant and she leaves and goes back to Scotland, I guess.
Well, she was pregnant when she arrived
at
the observatory, which is why she was willing to take a job as a domestic servant, because she was desperate. But he immediately recognized her intelligence and moved her over to the observatory and taught her how to do computing and how to look at the photographic plates, and then helped her go home to Scotland to have her baby, and promised her a real job if she would come back.
Yeah.
So she did.
She did.
She came back and she gave her a real job. She worked there for the rest of her life, and she became the first woman to hold a university title at Harvard. She was the curator of astronomical photographs. And the funny thing is, over the years, that job has stayed a woman's job.
Yeah.
And there is a woman now in charge of those 500,000 plates who is the curator of astronomical photographs.
The feelings, this has obviously changed, but in Wilhelmina's time, wasn't there a sense that higher education would make a woman unfit for marriage?
Yes. There had been a book published claiming that if a young woman devoted energy to studies at college age, that it would be so detrimental that her reproductive organs would atrophy. And so that was in the 1870s, right around the time a lot of the women's colleges were being established, Smith and Mount Holyoke, both from that decade. And it took till the middle of the next decade for a study to debunk that claim and show that, in fact, women who went to college had actually had children, and this was nonsense.
Right. I want to ask about Annie Jump Cannon, another great character in the story. Annie was particularly adept, I guess, at sorting stars into categories.
Yes, she was the one who really perfected the classification system so that it was adopted by observatories everywhere. And astronomy was an international pursuit, and she was internationally known. She went to meetings in Europe of other astronomers. She was in correspondence with astronomers all over the world. And she had a delightful personality, in addition to being so adept and quick with her judgments, and accurate, too. But she would get to know the families of the astronomers. She would have a separate correspondence with their children. Later, she'd be invited to the children's weddings. She had a jolliness about her that just made her a much loved figure.
Is it true she was the first woman to be able to get to actually use the telescopes?
When she came to the observatory in 1896, she was doing observations at the telescope. She was the first one at Harvard. And certainly women who'd studied astronomy were using telescopes before that. But at the observatory, the women's jobs had been strictly about computation or looking at photographs, not making their own observations. But she was the first given that privilege because of her educational background and the amount of experience she brought with her when she came.
I want to come back to Cecilia Payne. Let's talk about Sergei. Is it Gaposchkin?
I think that sounds great.
Okay.
It's probably better than I could say
quite
it.
Sure.
Yeah.
When Cecilia meets him, he's basically a man without a country. I mean, the Germans think he's a Soviet spy. The Russians think he's a German spy.
And he has
nowhere to go.
He's just stuck. Right. So he was in Germany. He was working at an observatory there. He had just lost his job because of this concern about him. And he knew there was an astronomy meeting taking place and that Cecilia Payne, whose work he had seen in journals, was going to be there. And he had the sense that she was of the age of Miss Cannon. So he was really surprised to find her a young woman, very close to his own age. And he had prepared a document describing his life story, his desperate circumstances, and she agreed to help him and managed to get him hired at Harvard and helped get a visa for him and do all the legwork that enabled him to come to this country. Then she married him.
And married him. And you say in the book, no one really noticed that there was a romance blooming between them. They both seemed like, you said, kind of lonely astronomers in their mid-30s, but that they had made a connection.
I think people at the observatory just thought so highly of Miss Payne that they just weren't looking. They didn't see what was happening.
You say they had the observatory pretty much to themselves through the war years, World War II, that is.
Right. Right. The male students and young astronomers were in the service, and the women were doing other kinds of work. Mrs. Shapley was calculating missile trajectories for the Navy, and some of the other women were teaching celestial navigation to the armed forces. Everybody was busy, but the Payne Gaposchkins were at the observatory.
It seems like they kind of had an idyllic childhood for their kids. And they were remarkable people. They took in a Japanese family at a time when Japanese Americans were being interned in camps on the West Coast.
Right. Right. They had a very global perspective. It's good to think about that in these days. Don't you think?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Harlow Shapley asks this really interesting question after World War II, and it's, should the observatory help in, as he puts it, the creation of international scientific institutions as part of its contribution to international sanity? Of course, there's a lot of concern about what the atomic age is going to mean. Mm-hmm. Would you just say something about this period?
Well, having seen the carnage of the war and the use of atomic weapons, he was appropriately horrified. And astronomers like to look out into the universe and think so broadly that national differences don't really mean much. Or in an ideal research environment, they're completely meaningless. The astronauts say this too, that when they're on an international team on the space station, they're looking down at the Earth. You can't see borders between countries. Just looks like a tiny little place.
Yeah.
And would be much healthier for everyone if we could all adopt that philosophy.
Yeah. No one working today, you say, uses glass plates to photograph the skies anymore. I mean, it's technology that's, I guess...
Everything's digital, right.
Yeah, everything's digital. But you do point out that none of this new digital technology can document what the skies looked like in that era. And in that sense, they're irreplaceable, I suppose.
They are. And they are being digitized because there's some concern that eventually the emulsion might separate from the glass. So they're all being copied now in a process that had to be invented on site. So the plates have to be cleaned, and then they are scanned. The cleaning involves taking off markings that were put there by these women and some of the men also. Because when you saw something interesting on a plate, you could just make a note right on the glass to call Nice. Other people's attention to it. But for the digitization process, that all has to come off. So the plates are photographed first with the markings on them, and then they're cleaned, and then they get scanned. And the reason, one reason for doing this is that they're still in use. So once they are available online, astronomers won't have to make the trip to Harvard to look at them, and there won't be the concern of handling the... I mean, they are glass, so they're fragile.
Yeah.
And it'll just be easier for everyone. So when you're looking at a particular part of the sky, you want to know, well, what was happening there 100 years ago?
Right.
And you can find out
yeah.
in the Harvard Plate Collection. It is unique. There are other glass plate collections at other observatories, but nothing as extensive as what Harvard did.
Dava Sobel, her book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. After a break, we'll be talking about a play opening this week in Salt Lake City from the Pygmalion Theater Company, which focuses on the life of Henrietta Swan Leavitt. You can get information about all of this on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the remarkable women at the Harvard College Observatory who slaved over tens of thousands of glass plates and made crucial discoveries about the cosmos. One of the stories in Dava Sobel's book is about Henrietta Leavitt, and that's been brought to life and fictionalized by the playwright Lauren Gunderson. Her play, Silent Sky, is being produced by the Pygmalion Theater Company. It's opening this weekend. Earlier, we spoke with the play's director, Mark Fossen, and the actor, Hannah Minshew, who plays Henrietta. I guess the question is, like, what is this play? In the sense that it's not exactly a history, and it's one of the things that you've talked about is, you know, it wasn't intended as this resuscitation of facts, that there's something else. But how do you see the what it is, this portrayal?
I mean, it's somewhat fictionalized and streamlined, but it focuses, I think, on the story of it as opposed to the details. It doesn't get too wrapped up in a lot of the details and the timeline specifics. What it does is really tell the story of discovery. For me, the fact almost that it's a play about, but it's about women and it's about women astronomers in this time when they weren't allowed to even use a telescope is almost secondary to the fact that, for me, it's just a play about scientists. It's about the wonder of discovery, not as much about the oppression that they were going through. Because
it's almost beside the point.
Yeah, the joy of discovery that's there in Henrietta is just so compelling to me. I just find it exciting.
Yeah. Do you see it that way too?
Yeah. I don't think it certainly has those themes in it, but that's not the main story. That's not the story that is being told. It just happens to be in there.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Yeah, it isn't the story about men and how they oppressed women. It's the story about these women that discovered the size of the universe, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Lauren Gunderson? I won't have you speak for her necessarily, but she's obviously interested in these stories. And science. I read something where she said, I think science is about discovery and a lifelong quest, and any lifelong quest is drama.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can see the connection she's making there between theater and science, I guess.
Definitely. I think that what's so wonderful in this play is that Henrietta talks a lot about that she wants to know where we are, where we belong in the universe. And she's speaking about that both scientifically, where does the planet Earth and the Milky Way reside in cosmic geography? But she's also talking about where she belongs. What is her place in the universe? And that's very human. I mean, that's very basic. Where do we all belong? How do we fit in a world that maybe doesn't want to make room for us? How can we find a landscape for us to live in if we don't sort of fit the norms of the time that we're living in? And that's really powerful. And I think that Lauren can really see that science isn't just a bunch of facts. And it isn't just about sort of the trivia of where we are. It's actually a big question about who we are and where we belong in the universe. And I think that's really fundamental and powerful, even if you're not following the exact science of how Cepheids work in the Magellanic Cloud.
Yeah, right.
You know, that. But you can understand somebody fighting to figure out where they belong.
Henrietta says that light has never let her down.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, as the play begins, how she's thinking about it, because it seems like she's got those deeper existential questions. She's more science than religion, but that's kind of a basis, at least for her at first, it seems.
Yeah, I think she grew up, her father was a pastor.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of that vocabulary she changed to fit her ideas. And so when she talks about the science of light on high, it's her way of kind of knitting them together in some way. And throughout the play, you see her kind of say those things. Like she says that her heaven is a cosmos deep in a gorgeous void. Full darkness with immaculate combustion, which is language that her sister, who is very religious, would understand.
Yeah.
It's just a beautiful combination of these gorgeous words that are usually considered to be religious or have some kind of religious connotation, but with science.
Yeah, she puts a different spin on it.
Yeah.
Ellen Fagweist, who reviewed the play for the Salt Lake Tribune, I like what she said. She says that Henrietta is trying to calculate the size of the universe based on the brightness of stars, all the while she's negotiating the scale of other relationships in her life. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, I would agree. She's got this one goal in mind of figuring out where we are. And she doesn't necessarily know how she's supposed to do that, but she knows that she is the one who's going to do it. She's going to be the one who solves this big issue. But then she's also being thrown all of these curveballs from, like, this man who comes into her life who she kind of falls in love with. And then these relationships she develops with the other human computers. And it's suddenly not just about the science.
That's kind of what the play is, right? I mean, there's that science, but then it's the drama of her, the questions of her relationships in her life.
Yeah, and I think that there's this point that, like you say, that Henrietta wants to figure all this out, but there's a point that she comes to later in the play where she comes to a realization she just wants to be a part, even a small part of something mm-hmm. bigger than herself. And that is part of the science, but that's also part of her relationship. She's happy to be part of a community and a family that she sort of builds around herself, where she finds other like-minded people.
She's intense. Yeah?
Yeah.
Deeply passionate.
Yeah.
And ambitious? Can we describe her that way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Because this thing that she's trying to figure out, she wants to be the one who understands it, figures it out.
Yeah. There's a line her sister says toward the end of the play where she basically says, you think that if you can't solve it, it's never going to be solved. And that's kind of what she believes because she's got a bit of an ego. But yeah, she's intense and passionate and she's going to be exceptional come hell or high water.
Do you see this sense of ambition in conflict with the decision about relationships in her life? Like, is she having to choose in some way between love and acclaim, you know, in her career? And I don't want to give too much away,
yeah.
so let's be careful with that. But this is a decision that she's having to make, and yeah, I'll put it that way.
Far. She has a series of decisions that she makes. Sort of once she gets on the trail of figuring out the size of the universe, mm-hmm. she then has to make decisions about romantic love and familial love,
yeah.
and how she balances those. And one thing that we talked about in rehearsal is just, there's a cost to each one of those decisions.
Yeah.
Whichever one, she cannot satisfy all three at the same time, her scientific curiosity, her romantic love, and her family. And so she has to prioritize one over the other, and each of those takes a toll. Each of those takes a cost when you pick A over B over C.
Yeah.
Something happens, and those complicate the story and complicate her life and sort of make her change her mind about some things, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, without giving too much away.
How do you describe her relationship with her sister? It seems like her sister represents this kind of grounding of home, the tug of maybe religion in some way too, do you think?
Yeah, they are so close. I think her relationship with her sister is the most important relationship in the play. But yeah, there is the they speak two completely different languages, and you see that throughout little scenes in the play. But they're saying the same thing. They love each other, and there's big conversations that they have about whether or not heaven is real or whether or not it's just science, and are those mutually exclusive, or can they come together? And it's really, really fascinating, like, discussions, and it's all based around this love for each other, and they want to understand one another. And Margie, the sister, does ground Henrietta, I think, especially when sometimes her ego gets out of control.
Which it does from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did Henrietta change the way we see the world and the universe?
It gets summed up so late in the play, and it was one of those
lines
that just sort of gave me chills. But, I mean, she literally discovered the size of the universe. At the time that she was making these discoveries, we thought the Milky Way was the extent of the universe, that was it. A few hundred light years away, that the whole universe was just a few hundred light years wide. And then she makes these discoveries and contributes to a conversation with other scientists. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like she does it all by herself. She is part of something larger. Her work contributes to the work of Hubble.
Yeah.
And we find out just how vast the universe actually is, and completely then changes our perspective. Again, it's sort of the next discovery after, you know, the Earth is not the center of the solar system. We figure that out with Copernicus, and then we're moving on and on. And for a while, we think, well, at least we're in the Milky Way galaxy, but that's it. We're still really important. And then we get this discovery that, no, there are billions of other galaxies just like us. And it changes your perspective on everything and just the size of the universe that we're able to inhabit. And it's just a complete perspective shift, I think.
Do you want to add to that?
I couldn't even imagine the, like, philosophical questions that would come from you once thought that the universe was just not very vast.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's just endless.
It's as if you imagined that, you know, your local neighborhood was the extent of everything. And then all of a sudden you see, oh, my gosh, there's a nation. Oh, there's a whole world of people that are live outside of my block.
Well, and then put it in the context of the time. This is more than 100 years ago.
Yeah,
pretty close to that.
Is it true, Hannah, you had considered being a geologist? That's mentioned in the Salt Lake Tribune thing. And I do wonder if the part of you that wanted to be the scientist – versus the part of you that wanted to be the artist, if you can relate to Henrietta in that sense.
Yeah. I wanted to be a geologist. I really, really liked it. I'd taken a bunch of college courses while still in high school, and I thought that's what I was going to do. But I also had this other love of theater. And yeah, I can relate to – my father called me the other day and he had read the script and he said, it is not a far cry from you as a person. And I said, yeah, I would agree. I totally relate to a lot of her struggle between the science and her relationships. And it, like, I had a struggle between choosing between science and art and theater.
Do you think in that sense that a lot of women will relate to the story and the choices that you make?
I think not just women. I think all people in general. It's a very human story with human issues and themes, and we all feel these things when we have to choose between several different things. We have to sacrifice something for family or for our careers. We all feel those things, and then to also have the themes of creating a family. Not necessarily like your biological family, but like a home away from home.
It's Hannah Minshew, who plays Henrietta Leavitt in Pygmalion Productions' Silent Sky. Mark Fossen directs the play. The play opens this Friday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center's Black Box Theater. It runs through May 13th. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.